You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Tuesday, November 24th, 2015, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
Jay is actually better this week, but he is traveling. He is in Colorado for the holidays, and he's trying to get his crappy laptop to work.
It's called the crap top.
So he'll join us if and when he gets his computer to actually work so that we can hear him. So we're recording a little bit early this week because Thanksgiving is coming up in the United States. If you're an American, it's... Yeah, well, everyone celebrates Thanksgiving, right?
There's no
everyone
gets the day off. It doesn't matter what your like religion or your traditions are.
It's like Halloween in that regard.
Yeah. Oh, except kind of? Some super religious people are like afraid of Halloween.
Are they? They're afraid of Halloween?
Yeah.
But they get All Saints. Like, they get All Saints Day the next day. I don't get it.
But they think it's evil. Like, I think that... the ones that come to your door, Jehovah's Witnesses, they don't celebrate Halloween.
They don't know what they're missing.
I know.
Yeah, but I don't think they celebrate Thanksgiving either.
Aw,
no, they don't.
Bummer.
They don't. They don't.
They don't celebrate birthdays and
birthdays.
Yeah, none of that stuff.
Sad. I like Thanksgiving.
I like Thanksgiving as well.
Oh yeah.
What's not to like?
Right?
Food and football.
Football. Some of your family and friends.
Ooh,
it all ends in pumpkin pie.
And then there's always one or two family members. It's like, oh, okay. It's Thanksgiving. I'll deal with it.
For me, Thanksgiving is always an orphan Thanksgiving. It's always just the people left in LA who didn't go home. Yeah, it's really fun. And I found this great grocery store that makes vegan versions of a handful of things because my boyfriend has a dairy allergy. And he's so funny because he loves meat. So we're always buying vegan things and then adding meat to them.
Isn't that
don't tell them at the school.
The laws of physics?
Exactly.
All right, well, Kara, we're going to start with what's the word this week. And I'm excited about this one.
Yeah, well, I'm excited about this one too because this was Steve's recommended word. Do you remember, Steve, what made you want to cover it? Like were triggered?
I read it somewhere.
Nice.
I can't remember now.
So this is a word that I think most everybody has come across, but they might not really understand the definition. So the word of the week is homeostasis. Homeostasis is the tendency of a system, especially that of a living organism, to maintain internal stability or equilibrium, often owing to some sort of coordinated response within the body that will react with regards to a stimulus. So a really good example of that would be maybe the maintenance of pH of your blood or the maintenance of a steady body temperature in warm-blooded animals. So for humans, we need to keep our body temperature right around 98.6 degrees. That's Fahrenheit. What is
that?
Yeah,
although, the 98.6, that's fake.
It's really specific, isn't it?
Yeah, that's way too specific. There's like, about a 2 degree variable there, like 98 to 100.
Yeah, so if we were using Celsius, which we use in science, that would be what, 37 degrees,
yeah,
which is probably more of a standard.
Yeah.
So yeah, 37 degrees, we'll go with that. In order to homeostatically regulate that 37 degrees, what we'll often do is we'll sweat if our temperature becomes excessive, we'll shiver in an effort to produce heat if we are hypothermic. And we'll also generate heat through metabolic processes to try and get our core body temperature up. Blood pH has an even tighter control. Your blood pH has to really be maintained. And so we've got a bunch of buffer systems, the carbon dioxide that we breathe and things like that to help keep your albumin that helps keep buffer your blood pH. But homeostasis also has other definitions that are related. So in psychology, they often use homeostasis to talk about sort of a psychological equilibrium that's obtained when somebody has a drive or attention and then they reduce it. In entomology, so insects, scientists will talk about how members of a colony of social insects will behave cooperatively. So maybe like bees will all fan their wings at the same time in order to cool down a beehive. Very cool. And then in ecology, we will hear the term stoichiometric homeostasis. And that's kind of like stoichiometry, balancing an equation. So that is actually describing the relationship between organisms and all of the nutrients within a closed system that they recycle. Kind of like the story we did a few weeks ago about whale poop. So the etymology of this word, it actually comes, we can pin it down to the exact author. I love it when that happens. From 1926, coming from the Greek homeo and stasis, homeo meaning similar and stasis meaning standing still, which together lead to the idea of staying the same. It was first described actually in French by physiologist Claude Bernard, who called the process interior milieu. And that was actually in kind of the 1850s. And so he started talking about the interstitial fluid of your cells and how there are changes that occur, in order to keep your interior milieu intact. And then later, an American physiologist and also the chair of the Harvard Physiology Department, Walter Bradford Cannon, coined the term homeostasis because he was interested in Bernard's work and followed up on it. And just as an interesting side note, the same man, Walter Bradford Cannon, who coined the term homeostasis, also coined the term fight or flight response. So
interesting.
Busy.
What I like about the concept of homeostasis is that once you really understand it, it helps you understand biological systems. Mm. But also, there's a lot of alternative medicine, nonsensical treatments, or you know, beliefs about health and disease that completely fly in the face of homeostasis.
You're right.
Yeah. So like treating your blood pH, it's bullshit. There's nothing you're going to do short of poisons.
Yeah, sort of injecting something.
Yes, that's going to throw off your body's, your blood's pH because it's a very tightly regulated homeostatic system. There are feedback loops, often multiple feedback loops. That's one thing that evolution is really good at. Mm-hmm. You know, when evolution has to innovate, then it's subject to chance, right? But once you have a system, evolution very quickly will go to an optimal state, you know? And when you have homeostatic systems with feedback loops, selective pressures will very quickly bring it to an optimal state. And you can't just game it. You can't just do something that's going to throw off a homeostatic system like that. So you can't easily affect blood pH. Again, things that do that, things that alter your blood pH are generally considered poisons and they'll kill you.
Yeah, it's kind of like when a lot of people don't realize this, but when you hyperventilate. The reason you want to breathe into a bag is not so that you can, you know, somehow get more oxygen. It's so you can recapture your CO2, because if you blow too much CO2 out of your blood, CO2 is an acid, right? When it goes, when it makes carbonic acid. So your blood will actually alkalize if you hyperventilate. So you got to recapture that CO2 to keep your blood pH where it needs to be.
Yeah.
It's interesting, but you're right. We have redundant systems. Like, we have multiple things that keep these things in check. And yeah, so many bullshit alternative treatments almost do the opposite.
Yes.
They try to force your body into a position, and your body's like, no, not doing it.
Yeah, there's even a breathing pseudoscience, you know, where you force yourself to breathe a certain way. It's like, no, just your body will breathe the way it wants to breathe. Let it breathe.
That's like having a pseudoscience control.
Yeah. Think about your flu and anything biological, like the amount of fluid you have in your body. You know, your desire to drink and how much pee you make and how concentrated it is. Very, very tightly regulated with multiple feedback loops. The nervous system, Carrie, you know this, it's loaded with feedback loops. My favorite is the basal ganglia, because moment to moment, there's this complicated feedback loop in the brain that regulates how smooth your movements are, basically. It essentially is regulating the gain of the connection between your desire to move and the amount that you move. And that keeps it in this optimal, very narrow zone so that you move just as much as you want to, no more, no less. And if that system gets broken, you know, it results in things like Parkinson's disease, where you can't move.
Can't control.
Or you get at the other end, you get chorea, where you're moving too much and you can't stop moving. But these are all homeostatic systems that are based on multiple feedback loops that keep things within very, very narrow parameters. The other one more is the oxidative stress antioxidant system. That's a homeostatic system too.
Oh, so when you're taking grape juice with extra antioxidants and stuff, you think you're affecting it, but guess what? You're not.
Either you're not, or if you are, it's bad. Because why would you
want a lot of grape juice?
Yeah, I mean, the evolution's already optimized that balance in that system. You can't change it in a simplistic way by taking a lot of exogenous antioxidants and think that that's going to somehow improve the whole system. So just that's this one concept of homeostasis. Just always think about that when you think of any biological system, and it probably will help you understand it better.
And if you have a hard time understanding it at a physiological level because you're, you know, you haven't brushed up much on your biology, there are really cool examples of biomimicry where technologists have used the idea of homeostasis in tools. Like your thermostat uses homeostasis.
Yeah.
When you set it to a particular temperature, it has sensors that say when it's dropping too low or too high, and it will turn on your air conditioner or your heater or turn them off accordingly. That is a really straightforward homeostatic system.
All right. Thanks, Kara. All right, Bob, you have an interesting news item this week. There's some ultimate limit to the resolution with which we can see the universe.
Yeah, this one really fascinated the hell out of me. Scientists have made a dire prediction of sorts that the resolution of deep space galaxies may hit a fundamental wall that we won't be able to surmount, and that our next generation telescopes might actually be hitting this wall. Now, a great analogy for this is our naked eye view of the stars right in our backyard. We've all seen it. You look at the stars and they twinkle, right? Yeah. Astronomers call this.
Especially the little ones.
Astronomers call this. Astronomers call this scintillation. Scintillation, and it's caused by a horrible thing called our atmosphere. At least from an astronomer's point of view,
it only keeps us alive,
right? That's not very helpful. So the ultimate cause, though, is turbulence in the atmosphere, and this turbulence is created by all the temperature and density fluctuations. So what do we do about that? Well, we put the best telescopes on high mountains to get above as much air as atmosphere as possible, and also because the air is dry and stable, and that helps out a lot as well. The other thing we could do to really deal with it is to get the telescope into space. So Hubble, above the atmosphere, like the Hubble, like lots of other platforms we have up there. That's a great way to do it. On the Earth, you could use adaptive optics to basically synchronize the shape of the lens to the turbulent atmosphere. And that just kind of cancels out the twinkling. And so those are two great ways to do it. There may be another level of distortion that is even more pervasive and a lot nastier.
Space dust.
Now, oh God, much more fundamental. So a new study by scientists at the International Astronomical Union General Assembly predicts that there's a fundamental resolution limit to the universe that's going to forever prevent us from seeing distant galaxies at the highest level of detail that our instruments would otherwise allow us. So what they're saying is that there's this distortion effect is kind of enmeshed within space-time at its most fundamental quantum level, down to length scales approaching 10 to the minus 35 meters. It doesn't get much tinier than that. This regime is known as the Planck scale.
Yeah.
Now, we could actually directly probe the Planck scale, except for these two non-trivial problems. It would require energies about a quintillion times greater than what we could muster in our best particle accelerator. So, yeah, it's going to take an amazing, unfathomable amount of energy to even get there. A quintillion? Yeah, we're pretty far from that. But also, even if you could somehow produce a sufficiently energetic light at that small of a wavelength, which is called the Planck energy scale, the light would actually turn into a black hole. Because it would be so energetic that it would just collapse in on itself, forming a black hole, and of course swallow any information that it would be sending to us anyway. So basically, that's at that scale, there's really nothing we could directly probe. It's impossible. But we do have a pretty decent consensus about what's going on down there, kind of giving that at that scale this roiling, bubbling character that they call quantum foam. You may have heard of that term before.
Yeah.
Right? So these particles, even if they're around just for the briefest amount of time, they have energy and therefore mass. So this mass, minuscule as it is, would necessarily have to warp space by a certain amount. Thank you, general relativity. And this then is the crux of the image resolution problem of the universe. So imagine that a photon traversing the cosmos from distant galaxies, those photons would cover such immense tracts of space that all these tiny little bends in space-time or phase perturbations, they could potentially add up To blur the image, much like our atmosphere does. So unfortunately, getting around that is not as easy as just lofting a Hubble telescope into space or even employing adaptive optics. In fact, this is probably completely insurmountable. There is probably no way around that at all. So now this hasn't happened yet, since none of the images that we've been able to produce with any of our telescopes are resolved enough to even hit that wall. But the scientists predict, most disturbingly, that the next generation of scopes, perhaps the James Webb Space Telescope, could potentially hit this wall of maximum resolution for deep space objects.
So the quantum foam is like the atmosphere of the universe.
Right. Exactly. Oh, so okay. That's really kind of the big bummer. I get really frustrated thinking about that because, as you know, I love imagining far, far future tech. And imagine a telescope as big as the solar system, some unusual design of telescope that big, and using it to see details of continents, or seeing a volcano erupt on a planet a million light years away. That should be possible with a telescope at that scale. But even with the technology like that, we'd never be able to get a really amazing image that you would imagine from a galaxy's billions of light years away because of this fundamental resolution limit. So that's just a silly little aside, but this is something that could be true. It's not certain. This is just a theory, but it's not going to take generations to develop this technology. We might be ready with this technology soon. I mean, when's James Webb is going up fairly soon? Was it a couple years or so? We may actually notice it. I mean, still it's going to produce amazing images, but it's just so frustrating to think that there's this fundamental limit that our technology will never be able to get around. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, even though we might not be able to imagine it today, if that fundamental limit exists, yeah, I bet you we're clever. Some future scientist will figure out a way to compensate for it.
The quantum foam compensator. Turn it on. Oh, that's much better.
Or quantum foam phase inverter. I like that even better.
Yeah. I've thought of that, Steve. I thought there might be some trick that we can do, and I wouldn't be shocked if somebody did eventually come up with that. But just think of the problem you've got. I mean, when we, you know, the adaptive optics that we use, you know, what do they do? They shoot a laser into space to basically make an artificial star, and they determine how that star is being disrupted by the atmosphere, and they use that information to change the shape of the lens that they're using to compensate. So that trick clearly won't work, because you can't possibly sample, you know, key sections of space billions of light years away to kind of compensate for that. So yeah, but there could be some trick, but man, it's not looking good.
Yeah.
It's maybe fundamental.
But we still may be able to see a planet in our own galaxy.
Oh,
really?
I mean,
close up theoretically.
Yeah, that's theoretically. I think for sure we could do that. For sure, that's not going to be a problem. So yeah, so our galaxy, Jesus, only, I mean, the far end is what, 70,000-80,000 light years from where we are. I mean, that's not a problem. We're talking billions of light years before it gets really nasty.
All right. Well, a new study was published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, Kara, I know it's your favorite science journal. And looking at, it's actually by a researcher at Yale, Justin Farrell, who was looking at the messaging from different organizations on climate change, comparing those organizations that receive corporate funding versus those that don't. And he found something that is not surprising at all. Found that when you look at the organizations that receive corporate funding, you know, funding from like ExxonMobil or other, you know, fossil fuel producing companies, there was a pattern. And there was a pattern, first of all, of communication and sort of coordination of messaging among the organizations. But second, that there was a pattern that in the messaging itself, they were polarizing. The thematic, he writes that the thematic content of these polarization efforts and the discursive prevalence of that thematic content over time was evident. So that, yeah, so essentially, you know, there was the attempt to ideologically cast doubt and confusion on the consensus of global climate change. And also, he said that they were, not only were they trying to simply cast doubt on the scientific consensus, they also produced their own science to counteract it, you know? Mm-hmm. But how he said that he did not find that pattern when looking at non-corporate funded organizations. There was no pattern of polarization or of coordinated network of messaging. Again, not a surprising finding at all, in my opinion. I wrote about this today and talked more about the nature of scientific consensus, what comes up a lot on the show, because we tend to go along with the scientific consensus. But it is incredible to me that still the denialist messaging has been, to some extent, so successful that it's actually convinced people, especially over issues that they care about, that it's okay to dismiss the scientific consensus, and that it's even that's the skeptical thing. You're not being a skeptic if you just believe the authority figures, right? So they didn't say that that's an argument from authority, which is not true. That's a misapplication of that logical fallacy. So it's always good to remember that, why we respect the scientific consensus, because it's, first of all, the scientific consensus by definition is based upon science and evidence. It's relevant experts in a field hammering out what we know. And if the evidence is convincing enough, then there's a tendency for the scientific community to sort of come together with a single opinion. Usually, and we see this in medicine all the time, when the evidence is weak or preliminary, opinions proliferate, right? Everyone will have their own opinion, about what the best way to treat something is. Once we have really solid evidence, that's the standard of care. Everyone has the same opinion.
That's it. Everyone adapts.
Yeah. It's the same thing in science in general. When the data is preliminary, when it's conflicting, there may be multiple schools of thought. We talk about this on the show a lot of the times too. Was there a meteor strike in North America or not causing the mass extinction 12,000 years ago? For example, that's a genuine scientific controversy. And we're going to talk next, Evan, about The Hobbit, the Homo floresiensis, is that a new species or isn't it? That's a legitimate scientific controversy where scientists are still waiting and debating over the evidence. But eventually, with many things, you get enough evidence where a consensus emerges. And, and it's not black and white. The other thing is, I think a lot of the times that the critics or contrarians will ridicule use of the term quote-unquote settled science, arguing that science is never settled. And I do think that settled science is an unfortunate phrase, because I think it's confusing in context. What quote-unquote settled science refers to, I think legitimately, is when you have to make a decision based upon the evidence. It doesn't mean the science stops. It doesn't mean that, it's not open to revision. It just means we're ready to make a decision. We're ready to act upon this information, and there is no current significant controversy surrounding the evidence. Vaccines are safe and effective. There's no significant legitimate controversy about that. That is settled science. That doesn't mean that we're not open to more evidence if it comes out. You know what I mean?
But it's kind of where the burden of proof shifts, right?
Right.
Where, it's no longer on the scientist to continue to produce evidence that this is legitimate. It's on any detractors to produce valid evidence that it's illegitimate.
Scientists have already met their burden of proof.
Yeah.
And now if you're going to disbelieve that or make any other claim, you have to meet an equal burden of proof. You have to at least contradict with an equal amount of evidence, the evidence that was used to support what is now the scientific consensus.
That's a key part of that, Steve, is that it's just not a matter of you producing some evidence. It would have – the implication is that you would need to produce quite a significant amount of evidence to counter what has been considered quote-unquote settled. It's not a trivial thing at all. Imagine what it would take to actually – disprove evolution at this point, the fact that evolution takes place. It's almost inconceivable that that is wrong. And imagine what it would take to convince people that, whoa, we had this totally wrong. It's incredible. It's mountainous.
It's at the point, with evolution is one of those scientific conclusions. It's at the point where
it's essentially impossible.
It can't be wrong. It could only be incomplete. We may discover that there is some more deep fundamental reality going on that we hadn't thought about, but as evolution has to be true as far as it goes. There is just no other explanation for all of the evidence that exists. Same thing like with DNA, is another one of my favorite examples. DNA is the molecule of inheritance, of inheritable information.
Mm-hmm.
It reminds me of a skeptic lecture you gave a very long time ago, but it always stuck with me, in that we're always going to know that the Earth is some kind of spheroid in shape. Yeah. We may refine its definition and tweak it a little bit, but tomorrow we'll never wake up and figure out, oh, it was a cube.
Yeah, we're never going to learn someday that the Earth is a cube. We just finer variations on some kind of spheroid. Exactly. That's that analogy, I think, was first proposed by Isaac Asimov, and I thought it was perfect. Huh. Perfect analogy for how science progresses. It doesn't progress by finding that what we used to think was wrong, just that what we used to once you get to the point where you've had a mature science, that it's obviously when you transition from pre-scientific to scientific thinking about things, you do find out that what we thought was wrong. But once you get to a certain level of confidence, it's just never going to happen that we're going to
figure out. It's all fine tuning
from there.
Mm-hmm.
And with every question, you have to decide sort of where you are along that spectrum. It's not like it's not black and white. It's not like either you have a consensus or you don't have a consensus. You could be anywhere along that spectrum. Like, I think evolution is pretty much as far as it gets. There's no way that that's going to turn out to be wrong. What's interesting with climate change is that we have a number. I don't know how accurate the number is, but we have a number. The IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change from the UN, said they're 95% sure that man-made global warming is happening. So they were that's their estimate, their number that they put on it. So that's pretty confident, but that's still, it's just 19 out of 20. It means one chance in 20 that they're wrong. So that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about evolution, which I think is, so close to 100%, you might as well treat it like 100%. But like with medicine, we often have to make decisions with, 90, 95% confidence, knowing that you're going to be wrong one time in 10 or one time in 20. And we can't wait until we're 100% certain, because by then it'll probably be too late to really do anything about it. It's like, we're not sure. Phil Plait came up with this analogy, which I also think is good. Yeah, we're about 95% sure this asteroid's going to hit the Earth. Are we going to wait till we're 100% sure that asteroid's going to hit the Earth before we build our rockets and start to plan the mission to try to? No, you have to act now. In fact, at what point would I say at 20% certain, I would want NASA to be doing something.
Mm-hmm.
At 30%, 40%, we're at 95%. When you think about how solid a consensus is, there's actually two numbers. There's what percentage of scientists agree with a certain conclusion and how sure are they? And we have both of those numbers with climate change. We have 97% of these climatologists are confident that man-made global warming is real, and they're 95% confident. So those are the numbers. I mean, again, you could quibble about them, but I don't think they're fundamentally different than those two numbers. Now, one other aspect to all of this, and that is, think about what the oil industry was able to accomplish with all of their resources. And we pretty much have smoking gun evidence now that they knew about global warming and were motivated to cover it up, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the New York State's attorney is bringing a lawsuit based upon that, by evidence that ExxonMobil, for example, their executives knew that this was going on. But in any case, they were not able to manufacture a scientific consensus that they wanted. All they really could do was cast doubt and confusion on the scientific consensus. The point is that conspiracy theorists casually assume that other industries can just manufacture a scientific consensus whenever they want. Big Pharma could manufacture a consensus on vaccines. Biotech could manufacture a consensus on GMOs, but there's really no evidence that they can.
They would have to manufacture so much data in some sort, in cahoots with one another over such a long period of time. Yeah.
Very big conspiracy.
And that's the thing. Like, usually when something is published in a peer-reviewed journal, and it turns out to be bullshit, it gets retracted.
Yeah. Or just other scientists say that's bullshit.
Yeah. But we have follow Retraction Watch. We have great watchdogs who keep an eye on this kind of stuff.
I agree. And then also, a lot of conspiracy theorists act like the United States is the only country in the world.
Oh, yeah. Like with UFO spottings, I always am amazed by this. Like somehow we were in cahoots with like Russia. Like really?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's crazy. The world governments would have to be in on this together.
Yeah. Right. There's no way.
They cooperate so often, so well.
I know. Yes. Like, and everyone's very good about keeping secrets.
Yeah. North Korea's just keeping all our secrets. That's right. Happening.
The subjective validation and the ad hoc reasoning becomes evident, right? So with climate change, it's the government that is behind it, right? Against the industry. But with GMOs, it's the industry that's behind it. And they're pulling the wool over the eyes of the government or the scientists. With Lyme disease, it's the insurance companies who are the villain. You could always find somebody to be the villain, and it's always somebody different. You know, it can be any part of the puzzle can be the villain as needed without any evidence. You just pick your villain.
But it is the government a lot, isn't it? It's like a common target.
Yeah, oftentimes
government's omnipresent.
The government
or
business, right? If you tend to be liberal, then you're more likely to blame corporations. If you tend to be conservative, you're more likely to blame the government. So it's partly ideological too.
There is some legitimacy to seeing the government and big business working together on their interests. The problem is when you take that and run with it in such an extreme way.
Yeah, well, sometimes they're working together, sometimes they're not working together.
Right.
You can create your narrative any way you want. Yeah. That's the ad hoc reasoning, and it doesn't have to be consistent at all. Whereas I think the skeptical position is consistent. You know, we're saying the science is the science. Yeah, I mean, yes, everyone has their own take on it, but it kind of all comes out in the wash. You know, as long as there's legitimate, mature scientists publishing rigorous data, that tends to trump corporate interests, government interests, whoever.
That's what's so fantastic about science. It's kind of out there on its own, separate in a way. I mean, sure, humans are still involved in the enterprise, but still it's kind of separate from all of that nastiness.
Yeah.
And in so many ways, it's self-correcting.
It's self-correcting, yeah.
Self-correcting.
And part of the self-correcting aspect to it is that everyone is not on the same page. You know, it's not like everyone has the same motivations. Different scientists have different points of view, or they work in different countries. Maybe private or government or industry or whatever.
And a lot of times it's the alternative of that, because scientists a lot of times feel competitive to publish first and to, there is some competition. So not only are they not working together, sometimes they're like not working together.
Oh, no, they are competing with each other, yeah. And they're keeping each other honest, and they have every motivation to tear down what another
scientist
is saying.
Which makes a consensus even more compelling.
Exactly.
Once you have
that
breakthrough,
exactly.
It's all these disparate pieces actually agreeing on something to a significant degree, that's compelling.
And I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen in real time. One of my favorite, because it was so dramatic, was IVIG versus plasmapheresis for Guillain-Barré syndrome. Again, a very wonky, medical controversy. Heated scientific controversy over which one was better, and two schools of thought pretty evenly divided. So they did a consensus trial. They did a huge, multi-center trial comparing the two treatments head to head. And everyone listened to the results of that study at the end. Didn't matter what school of thought you were a member of prior to it. Once the data came out, again, when the data is ambiguous, everyone has their own opinion. When the data is conclusive, everyone has the same opinion. It turns out, by the way, they were equally effective, so everybody won. But yeah, neither had an advantage over the other. So that's okay. Well, that was the answer. So
okay, that's
everyone
the result.
Now has the same opinion. All right, Evan, you're going to tell us about another scientific controversy about hobbits.
That's right. Hobbitses. Like all creatures of Middle Earth or planet Earth, each known critter has a taxonomical name. We're going to be talking about Homo floresiensis. In 2003, the remains of a relatively small humanoid were discovered on the island of Flores in Indonesia, hence the name. Measuring approximately 1 meter in height, the creature's diminutive stature had earned it the nickname, of course, the Hobbit. Now, some anthropologists have suggested that they are the remains of a Homo sapien, a human. But these humans may have suffered some sort of miniaturizing disorder. And then there's another set of scientists, including the discoverers, archaeologist Mike Morwood and his colleagues. They propose that a variety of features, both primitive and derived, identify these individuals as belonging to a new species, which they have named Homo floresiensis. It can't be both, can it? It either is a Homo sapien with a disorder of some sort, or it's either a human.
It's a human.
This new species or something else.
It's all human, modern human, when you're talking about Homo sapiens.
Right.
But interestingly, when the first Neanderthal skeleton was discovered, it actually did suffer from arthritis. And so it was not a modern human specimen, but it also was diseased. And in fact, that hunched over caricature of primitive humans derived largely from the fact that that first skeleton just was hunched over with arthritis.
How long did that last?
All from the first one. See, oh gosh. Yeah.
Still,
that's cultural. Yeah. It's cultural.
It's like Brontosaurus. They didn't take it down from the American History Museum for years.
But now it's back. Brontosaurus,
I know,
but now
it's back.
But as we were talking about before, good science practices demand that there be a robust debate and comparison between the multiple schools of thought here, and definitely there has not yet been a consensus on exactly what this creature is or was. But after 12 years of study, and it's going back and forth, the question is, where's the line? So what's the evidence which would sway, say, basically one side's analysis over to the other side? Well, the news from this past week regarding this critter is that researchers have performed a comprehensive analysis of the teeth from several hobbit jaws. And their evidence is suggesting that they are teeth belonging to a unique species rather than some sort of human or modern or relation to modern human with a growth disorder. Here's what they did. They compared the 40 known hobbit teeth with those from 490 modern humans from Asia, Oceania, Africa, and Europe, as well as from a variety of extinct hominins, such as Homo habilis. And some of the hobbits' teeth were small, as small as those from, say, short modern humans. But other features in other parts of the mouth, or the teeth, I should say, looked completely dissimilar from those of modern humans.
Mm-hmm.
So, here's what they told us. For specifically, the canine and premolar teeth looked primitive, whereas the molar teeth looked advanced, as if they had emerged later in the evolution of Homo sapiens. That's what the scientists concluded. So their findings contradict earlier claims that hobbits possessed teeth entirely like those of modern humans. So another piece of the puzzle has been entered into the arena. And now it's for the professionals to go back and forth and figure out if this will sway anybody into thinking differently about their prior thoughts.
Yeah, I've been following this from the beginning. It's like every time one side or the other published a study, it's like, we're right. No, we're right. No, we're right. It just keeps going back and forth depending on how you look at the evidence. The problem is that I suspect that this debate will not be settled with the existing fossils.
Mm-hmm. And so we'd have to find
too small a sample size.
So if we find new fossils of clear-cut Homo floresiensis, well preserved with some cranial and extracranial bones, that will settle the debate. If we never do, the longer we fail to find further specimens, the less robust the argument will be that it's a new species. But it will never really fully settle the debate. I think there'll still be holdouts. So it'll be a lot easier to prove that it is a new species than that it isn't a new species, I think. But I don't think this is going to be settled until new fossils are found.
I would agree.
If that's the case, Steve, what's lacking in the fossils that we have at this point?
Just number of specimens. Because you could still argue that one skull we have is a diseased human,
Right. Right, we've got the one skull, and we've got several fragments of skulls, like several jaws.
It's like if you have one specimen, it could be anything. If you have two, it's got to be a species, right? So that's the issue. We need a completely separate, complete enough specimen to say, this is absolutely a new species. That will end the debate. until then, they're going to, I think, dicker over the minutia. You know, it's what, you know, one time it's the cranial capacity or the shape of the cranium, and now it's the teeth, and then it's the facial bone structure. Yeah, so it's
the wrist bone. They were even looking at the wrist bones or the arm bones of the critter and saying, oh, it's human.
Why are you calling it a critter?
Because it's a hobbit's.
It's easier to say.
It's still a person. It's just not maybe a modern human.
I call people critters.
Okay. All right. I love that the writer of this article, Charles Choi, who I have to admit I know personally, and I think he's a great science writer, but I love that his headline called the teeth chompers. Because anytime you can say chompers instead of teeth, it makes me really happy.
Or critters instead of people.
Yeah,
or
okay. Critters. So, critters with chompers.
Chompers of a critter. All right. Well, Kara, you're going to tell us about mosquitoes and malaria.
Kind of the headline that we're discussing here is a new type of anti-malarial mosquito. And in order to understand this mosquito, you have to understand the technology behind it. So the technology is called gene drive technology. And like I said, it could mean the end of malaria as we know it, but it's probably going to have to pass through a bunch of technical and ethical hurdles first. So in order to understand this, we need to understand what a gene drive is. It's still pretty controversial. It's been on researchers' minds for over a decade. They've been theorizing it and they've been working on how to make it work. But earlier this year, there was a study that showed that it's highly, highly effective. So basically, in essence, the gene drive is a tool that's used to bias inheritance in offspring, causing a larger percentage of the progeny of a certain species to carry the desirable trait that you're looking for. So it's, you know, think of it this way. It's an engineered piece of DNA that copies and pastes itself into the genome. And then when the two organisms mate, the gene drive inserted from or inherited from one parent actually inserts itself into the gene inherited from the other parent so that the offspring have a significantly higher than 50% chance of being of having that trait, whereas in normal inheritance, we see like 50% on average, depending on the type of inheritance that we're talking about. It's really useful now, like it's become more advanced because of this CRISPR technology, which you've probably heard of, CRISPR. It's actually an acronym that stands for Clustered Regularly Interspaced Short Palindromic Repeats. But CRISPR is basically a genetic modification tool using Cas9, which is a specific protein. In this case, they use Cas9. And that helps researchers delete, add, activate, and even deactivate certain genes. The reason that it's such an improvement is because it happens fast, it's pretty accurate, and it's way less expensive than it used to be. And it uses plasmids, which is, you know, like bacteriophages, like viral bacteria, which is something that researchers have been doing for a while. This is just a huge improvement.
Yeah, the system, by the way, was derived from bacteria. It is a method that bacteria use to fine-tune their immune system against specific viruses.
Yeah, that they'll over a series of viral, I guess, punishments, they will make their immune system more specifically geared towards that. And they were able to use that natural process in bacteria and then basically harness it.
Yes.
In order to splice these genes and to put in genes that they want to do certain things. So let's talk about what those genes are. Before we talk about what those genes are, let's talk about the example from earlier this year, which was wildly successful. There were researchers at UCSD who used this technology, this gene drive technology, in a batch of fruit flies. And they expected it to sort of work, and it would take generation after generation in order to finally get a population that had the trait that they were looking for. They got it within like two generations, and it was something crazy, like almost 100% of the progeny contained the gene of interest. And they were like, holy crap, this works really well. And that is good, but it could be bad. And we'll talk about why. In the meantime, there was a researcher at UC Irvine, so another California institution, named Anthony James. And he'd been plugging away at this problem of malaria in mosquitoes, specifically a type of mosquito called Anopheles defensi, and that's the Indian mosquito that's the primary malaria vector in that part of the world. And he's plugging away at trying to figure out what to do about malaria in these mosquitoes. And he's already been successful at genetically engineering a mosquito to make antibodies against malaria using mouse genes. So he's done all this great work in the lab. And he's like, okay, I have this anti-malarial mosquito. How do I get it to spread? Meanwhile, this group at UCSD is like, holy crap, this gene drive is working really well in our fruit flies. So they get together and they say, what if my cargo, these genes in the mosquito that are anti-malarial, are carried by your gene drive technology? Maybe we can make a mosquito that when it breeds makes all of its progeny also have this anti-malarial property. But there were a lot of, you know, problems, right? When they first combined forces, one of them was that the cargo was massive. We're talking 17,000 DNA bases carrying these necessary genes, but eventually they figured it out. Also, when they first tried, the gene drive took only, it took in only two male mosquitoes of the total 25,712 in the experiment. So they had over 25,000 mosquitoes. They inserted these gene drives into them, and only two of them took it. And they knew that because they also inserted a gene that made their eyes change color so they could see them pretty easily under fluorescent light. The crazy thing is, even though only two male mosquitoes successfully got the gene inserted, the gene drive worked so well that by the third generation, 98.9% of the male progeny of those two male mosquitoes carried the drive. Now, I know what you're thinking, because I keep talking about male mosquitoes. Isn't it the female mosquitoes that bite? Aren't they the ones that require blood meal? Aren't they the ones that spread? Yeah, and that spread malaria. Yes, that is true. And the researchers do admit that they've had a harder time getting the females to accept the drive for various reasons. It seems like once they insert into the DNA, it actually just closes in on itself. And it like partially works. It splices the DNA, but they can't get the new package to insert appropriately. Also, the Cas9 protein that they're using in this CRISPR tool seems to be a little bit toxic to mosquitoes, so they have to be careful in their dosage and finding just the right delivery site. But the researchers are pretty sure that they can get past those hurdles and that this is a huge step forward. You know, they agree that the gene drive won't fully eradicate malaria, but it could eventually get the parasite under control so that it's no longer a threat to health and human safety. The problem here is that this is a regulatory nightmare, and it's a big open-ended ethics question. Is this okay to do? If we now have a tool that is so powerful that if we released these genetically engineered mosquitoes into a wild-type population, we know that within just a few generations, we could make sure that all the mosquitoes out there carried this genetic alteration. Is that something that we should do? What are the unintended consequences? Obviously, malaria is bad. We want to eradicate malaria, but what else could come along with this technology?
So they haven't gamed forward. They haven't made predictions as to what those might be.
I mean, I'm sure they're working on it, but there are huge multidisciplinary and multi-institutional hearings on this right now, because as soon as the first research came out that said, holy shit, this is really successful, a lot of people pushed back.
Yeah.
If we remember, there was that lab-grown H5N1. This was like in 2011 where they were able to insert it and actually cause a species jump in this virus. And immediately people rang the ethics alarm bells and said, should we be doing this research in the lab? And if so, how can we make sure that it safely stays in the lab? So this is a secondary ethical hurdle. We're talking about taking it outside of the lab. A lot of times when we talk about genetically engineered organisms like bacteria, viruses, and insects, this kind of research is done all the time, but usually there's a fail-safe built in so that one of the genes they inherit make it so it can't breed or make it so that it dies if it like loses a certain type of nutrition. But what we're specifically talking about here is a study that does the opposite. It wants it to breed. It induces it to breed and actually pass on this genetic trait very readily.
Yeah, we're talking about deliberately releasing it into the wild to change the wild populations of these insects. So we definitely have to be careful. So, Bob, I understand there's some kind of centennial with Einstein and relativity going on. Tell me, what's up?
Yeah, guys, this is actually happening now. This month is the 100-year anniversary of general relativity.
Wow.
General relativity. 100 years. This is a big one. There's actually been celebrations of sorts throughout the year. But in November 1915, Albert Einstein presented his field equations to the Prussian Academy of Science, a milestone in science. So those field equations describe how gravity is not a force transmitted across space-time. It was space-time itself curving in response to the matter and energy in it. Those curves are what our planet in orbit or a falling apple follows. And I love the statement that Archibald Wheeler famously made, roughly saying something like, space-time tells matter how to move, matter tells space-time how to curve. Kind of this interrelation, this big dance between space-time and matter and energy. So yeah. those equations that he talked about, in I think two or three different times during this time a century ago, they became the foundation of Einstein's general theory of relativity. And it all started as a thought experiment of an observer in free fall. That it all started there. Mm-hmm. And he slaved away for 8 years trying really hard to generalize his special theory of relativity. So when he was done, he was able to include acceleration into his theory, such as when an object falls in a gravitational field. Major milestone, like I said. So this dance between space-time and mass energy, or this relativistic conception of gravity, has passed every test that we've thrown at it, and it has given us amazing concepts like gravitational time dilation, gravitational lensing, frame dragging, black holes, and other concepts that are maybe not quite as confirmed as the other ones, things like gravitational waves, wormholes, closed time-like curves, which could potentially allow for the feasibility anyway of traveling to the past, and singularities. And it's still going strong 100 years later. There's still lots to figure out with general relativity, especially things like singularities. Do they even really exist? What are their real characteristics? Gravitational waves look good, but we still cannot find the smoking gun evidence of gravitational waves. I hope we do. And also the holy grail of physics is the union of quantum mechanics and relativity, so-called quantum gravity. If we ever do that, that is going to be a huge day in science.
Grand unifying theory. Awesome.
So guys, go online, just put in three words, general relativity and 100, and you'll see tons of articles discussing what he accomplished with general relativity and lots of the different activities that are going on all over the world to celebrate this. So check it out. Fascinating stuff. And congratulations to Einstein. One century.
One more just quick mention. This just came out today, the news that the Blue Origin rocket ship, which is a suborbital rocket, did a successful test flight today. You have the rocket and the capsule, a capsule that will eventually carry people. The capsule lands back to the ground with parachutes, but the rocket lands vertically on the ground using its rockets, descending like science fiction,
old school retro,
the rockets landing vertically. And the first ship to successfully do so. He beat SpaceX to the punch. Wow. So that's pretty incredible.
That is so cool.
Wow.
Still a ways to go before they'll be sending up people in those ships, but that's a great milestone.
Also, right. I love that Elon Musk is like an upset baby over it, and there's this hilarious Twitter conversation going on between Musk and Jeff Bezos where he's like, congratulations, but it is important to clear up the difference between space and orbit. And then it's like, no, we're okay here. Like, he keeps digging. If you look, he responds to almost every one of Jeff Bezos's tweets about how exciting it is to be like, it's not that exciting. And you're like, dude, Elon.
Sour grapes.
But that's fine. Let the billionaires fight about getting into space first. Healthy competition.
And Steve, I don't remember hearing you say that, but one of the key, not only is this cool, of course, but also the idea of reusability is supremely important.
Oh yeah.
In rocket technology, because it's just so expensive, so crazy expensive. It's really limiting what we are accomplishing in space, because it's like $10,000 per pound. So if we can actually get these rockets to come back down, that would be an amazing savings.
Yep.
And that's going to come to pass because of, I think, commercial space travel, because of things like this, because of the links at X-Corps who have this interest in taking people up kind of right into suborbital space and coming back in these parabolic flights. If people start paying for that more and more, I think the technology is going to get better and better.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, happen
soon,
sure.
Man. You gonna do? You guys gonna do it? You want to go to the edge of space?
Yes,
I would do it. Well, wouldn't yes. do it first, but
not first. List. Not first. You're
not
right.
Not first. Good call.
I don't have the right stuff for that. But
all right, we're gonna do one email this week. This email comes from Harry Livingstone or Livingston, and Harry writes: How do you manage to form objective political opinions about the world when the source of all your information tends to be a media outlet with a narrative of their own? This seems very relevant in the wake of the Paris attacks regarding foreign policy, but I find it true of most political opinion. What are the sources you go to as critical thinkers to form your opinions about the world? That's a really good question. The answer is, it is very difficult, in my opinion. Whenever there is a strong ideological angle to any question, it could be very difficult to get objective information. Because as you say, everything is sort of colored with a narrative. That's the first step, though, is to recognizing that that's the case. Mm-hmm. When I have conversations with people about political topics, they don't even realize that they have a narrative. That's when it's kind of hopeless. They just think that their information is the objective truth when it's so clearly just one narrative. Evan, your response to him, your email response to Harry was actually very, very good. I agreed with everything you said. You emphasized that you got to go to multiple sources.
Mm-hmm. That's right. You never rely on a single source. It's sort of like, what we've learned in science as well. Someone comes out with, they publish a study or something. That's great. You never rely on one study. You have to get more data. You have to compare and contrast how the event is also being reported. And you look for signs of obvious reporter bias or preferences and agendas that might be hidden within there. And you do. You have to go to multiple sources. It takes effort, like anything else. The more effort you put into something, I think the more you'll get out of it in the end. And it's unfortunately an effort that a lot of people either feel they don't have time to invest in, or they can't get over sort of their own inherent biases to be able to do that. You need to sort of learn those disciplines as you get along in life.
And that's especially tough when it comes to like geopolitical conflicts, because a lot of times we just don't have access to foreign language newspaper articles. We don't have translations of them. And so I think a really good example of that is Israel and Palestine. It's very hard for anybody living in the West who has never visited these areas and who doesn't really understand what's going on there to formulate a strong opinion that's not based on, as you said, kind of these personal narratives. It's just hard. It's just hard to get access a lot of times to seeing a conflict or seeing a difficulty really clearly with unbiased reporting, because a lot of times the reporting itself is just entrenched in the culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, Christopher Hitchens spoke to us about this when we interviewed him, that the news media is telling the story that's being told, and you're never going to really get the facts from the media. He said, he was being a bit cynical, but he said that's like the last place he would go to get information would be the media.
Yeah.
they're just regurgitating the narrative of the day, not really getting to the meat of the real facts. But, I think in all honesty, just as a private citizen, not somebody who is, working full time as an investigative journalist where you're going to vet information personally,
mm-hmm.
All you could really do is look for the common threads, look for the consensus, try to get as many different perspectives as possible. Plus, as you develop your skeptical chops, you get to realize which arguments are compelling, which one has red flags for being distorted or being propaganda or being a narrative, who has at the end of the day the best argument, and you begin to see, like, maybe you get an idea of what's really going on. There are some times, like recently, based on a discussion I was having with somebody, I always try to pull back emotionally. First of all, like, I don't have any position, right? I'm just trying to, I try not to be as non-ideological as I can. I know it's hopeless. You have to have some worldview, but I just try to minimize the effect that many biases have on my opinions about things. So I was in a discussion about the net economic effect of raising the minimum wage. Right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Seems like that's a pretty factual-based question, although I understand it could be complicated. But I tried as best as I could to find out what evidence there is and what the experts are saying on what the net effect is of raising the minimum wage. And I never got to the point where I felt like I had a good handle on the actual facts. Essentially, I found liberal economists telling a liberal story and conservative economists telling a conservative story. And that was it. And
that's the problem, right? Is that the experts themselves are often ideologues, especially if they're selling books.
Yeah. I found a couple of academic papers that were talking about some specific things, but it was really hard. Another one might be like, what's the net effect of gun regulations? You know, again, it's like you run into this quagmire of ideological opinions, and it feels like we don't have the data to really definitively answer a lot of questions. It's all there's enough conflicting data, enough limited data that you can look at it any way you choose. And you don't really get a good strong consensus out of it. So for some questions, it's really challenging.
It seems like a lot of data that journalists use, and I just put data in air quotes, is polling data. It's not actual investigative data. It's not scientific experimental data. It's polling data, which, as we know, you can get whatever answers you want in a poll. You just have to ask the question the right way. So that's a huge problem. I think a lot of it, too, just comes down to ultimately trying to find the sources that you trust the most, trying to find the least biased sources that time and time again are delivering on the information that you, that, like you said, has those common threads that's corroborated by other places. And, for different people, that might be different things, but there are a lot of ProPublica and Frontline, these areas that are funded by the common public. They're funded by people. They're not, based on advertising funds, and they definitely don't cater to a certain political ideology. They're there as pure journalism to just disseminate information to the public, which is really a dying art in this country.
Yeah.
It's a bummer.
It's a shame. I do think there is so much value in that type of journalism, where it's somebody who's just trying to really get to the bottom of the facts, completely divorced from any narrative or ideology. It's hard. There's still good reporters out there, but
completely.
It is more the exception now than the rule.
And you have to find them, you have to dig for them. But we still see it in newspapers, we see it in periodicals, we see it on television, and we see it in documentarians. But we also see a lot of bullshit. So, for me, that's something that I want to work on bringing to the SGU. We talk a lot about pseudoscience. I like to talk about pseudo-journalism. I like to talk about when a science story is reported really poorly, because that happens a lot.
That happens every now and then.
That's fresh meat for us all the time. Yeah.
Exactly.
The headline says invisibility cloak. Wait, this is nothing like an invisibility cloak.
And it happens in other arenas too. It happens in areas where the scientific process is, that muscle is being flexed, but it's not a scientific topic. And so I think that's also important. Let's apply the scientific method in most aspects of our lives. Let's at least try and think more scientifically, even about things like geopolitical conflict.
You know, what's interesting, though, too, is I've had experiences recently having discussions with various people. And, I think after 10 years, of doing this show, after 20 years, basically, of being an activist skeptic, I noticed that my skeptical colleagues and I really do argue differently than people who are not steeped in skepticism. The gulf has just gotten wider and wider, I think, over the years.
You're just less emotionally invested when you talk about those things?
The way people formulate their arguments, their use of evidence, just their use of logic is just so narrative driven, I think, at baseline. And we are so non-narrative driven. It's the exact opposite. It's hard. Sometimes it's hard when you get into a conversation and everything the other person says is a logical fallacy. You know what I mean? It's where do I, you would have to go launch into a long discussion about how to even have an argument before you could start to deconstruct and address what's going on,
So much misinformation flies and flies and flies that you could spend all year trying to refute just to correct the misconceptions that are coming out, let alone try to advance the discussion.
And it's not even just, you can't even get to the factual claims yet. You have to back way up and start to talk about how to even construct, how to even approach issues from a skeptical point of view or a logical point of view. And there's so much background work you'd need to do to really make any progress.
A good argument should be like sex. Like it should be like give, take, give, take. It shouldn't be just like masturbating. You know what yeah. I mean? Just like just regurgitating a bunch of stuff with like no effect. Is that a yeah. terrible analogy?
I heard sex and masturbation.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. You guys ready for this week?
More than last week.
Si, senor.
What happened last week? I think yeah, Bob and Kara got it corrected. Evan.
Yeah. Yeah.
Evan crapped out. Okay.
Yep, I crapped out. Stupid dark matter.
Go ahead. All right, here we go. Item number one, a new study finds that the Earth's magnetic field is much closer to flipping polarity than previously thought and may happen this century. Item number two, after sequencing the genome of the tardigrade, researchers found that about 6,000 genes, or over 17% of the tardigrade's genome, is composed of foreign DNA.
Ooh.
And item number three, engineers have made bionic roses with transistors and electrodes incorporated into the leaves and stem, including a rose that can change color when an electric current is applied. Bob, go first.
You study magnetic fields much closer to flipping than previously thought. Yeah, I don't know about that. That seems everything I've read on this, not recently, but everything, I wrote a blog post about this like last year, and so I've done research. We were, not close. I'm a little skeptical that we could potentially be really close. And it's also incredibly scary. And wow, this century, that would suck. Because you could go for, during the flip, you could basically not have a magnetosphere for decades or some crazy amount of time. That would be bad. The tardigrade, the bug, the water bear? I love those. Found that about 6,000 genes, 70% foreign DNA. That's a lot. That's a lot that foreign DNA. But considering the capabilities of the tardigrade, maybe that kind of makes sense because you could desiccate them for a century, add some water, and then it just starts walking around like nothing happened. It could survive the vacuum of space. I love these little critters.
Thank you.
So I can kind of see that a big chunk of their genome is foreign DNA. Let's see, you've got a bionic rose, transistors, cuneiform rose that can change color. Oh, wow, that's bizarre as hell. A bionic rose. Oof, wow, I don't even know what to think of that. I mean, it certainly doesn't seem like they can't do that. I'm just trying to think why. All right, yeah, so I'm going to say the magnetic field. I just refuse to think that that it's going to happen this century. It's probably millennia away. I'm going to say the magnetic field is fiction.
Okay, Kara.
Tardigrade, 17% of the genome is foreign. I don't know. That doesn't seem unreasonable to me. Bionic rose sounds crazy, but I want it to be true. Should I say it's true because I want it to be true? Let me see. Leaves and stem, including rose, that can change color when a current's applied. I want to buy that. I hope it lives forever too. It probably doesn't. It probably still dies like really fast, like shitty roses. The Earth's magnetic field is much closer to flipping polarity than previously thought. I think this one is the fiction because I feel like this is one of those doomsday kind of fear-mongery pseudoscientific headlines we read a lot. So I'm gonna agree with Bob and I'm gonna say that the Earth's magnetic field flipping soon is the fiction.
And Evan.
Well, I guess I'll just cut to the chase. I don't want to feel like I'm just following the herd along, but when I heard this one about the Earth's magnetic field, I had some reservations about this one. Like Bob said, he's written about that in the past. I've read some things in the past also. There's sort of this fear about that all happening, and it was never really well established as far as I'm concerned. I think people were, reading a lot into it, and I think that one's going to turn out to be the fiction. We're going to be okay with our magnetic field for the foreseeable future.
Moo. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wow. Wow. Okay. Does that mean Bob steered me in the right direction?
Thanks, Bob.
So let's take these in reverse order, since you guys all agree with number one. So you think that engineers have made bionic roses with transistors and electrodes incorporated into the leaves and stem, including a rose that can change color when electric current is applied. You all think that one is real, and that one is science.
That's crazy, though.
Bionic roses are real.
I want...
They genetically altered the rose?
How does it look, though?
No, they did this instead of genetically altering the rose.
And
the reason for this is so that they could study plant physiology. So it's a way of monitoring what's happening, you know, kind of at a cellular level in these plants while they're doing things like photosynthesis, you know, to see what's going on. But I think this, I also get the sense they did it just to do it and see what would happen. But yeah, they did mention that, like, one of them, the leaves change color when you apply a voltage. They call this technique flower power. It says these plants are still alive months later.
So they're not picked. They're actually still, that makes sense.
Yeah, they did it using living plants.
Oh, on the vine. Gotcha.
Not cut, yeah.
But it's not that the petals that change color, right? It's the leaves.
The leaves, yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Oh, okay.
But they probably change from, like, green to a slightly different green. Yeah, it says it right here. When a voltage is applied, the bionic leaves subtly change color between bluish-greenish hues.
All right, let's move on to number two. After sequencing the genome of the tardigrade, researchers found that about 6,000 genes, or over 70% of the tardigrade's genome, is composed of foreign DNA. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is... also science. Good job, everyone.
Water
bear. Did you say falso science?
Also science. Yeah, so tardigrades tardigrades are cool. That's, you could usually rely upon that. But this was very surprising. This was, I think, the most in any animal that they've ever, whose genome they've ever sequenced. 17.5% from foreign DNA, including DNA from it's mostly bacteria, but also from plants, fungi,
whoa,
and archaea.
Whoa.
Through a process of horizontal gene transfer, in which genes travel from one species to another rather than traveling just from parent to offspring, which is vertical gene transfer. Most species have less than 1%, you know, of their genes are from horizontal gene transfer.
That's it?
But the tardigrade, yeah, for some reason has 17.5%.
Huh.
So this is a new discovery. You know, they don't really know why it has so much. And they also don't know if there's any relationship between the fact that it has all these genes from other animals, other critters, including plants, and fungi and archaea, if there's a relationship between that and its ability to survive in extreme environments. They're wondering if those two things are related somehow.
Well, it certainly seems that way. I mean, if you're getting your genes from archaea, I mean, they're extremophiles. They are the kings of surviving anywhere, any place. So it certainly makes it much more feasible.
Is horizontal gene transfer and taking advantage of that, is that an adaptation in the tardigrade so that it can survive in extreme environments? Or is it just, it happens?
Epiphenomenon.
Yeah, it just is an epiphenomenon of the fact that for whatever reason, it has a lot of foreign DNA in it.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
I'm actually so upset.
I'm upset that you picked this, Steve, because I was going to blog about this for tomorrow, and now that you've chosen
you refused
to allow me to do that. So I'm
that's
like,
correct.
It was the perfect story. It's a crap.
Sorry. But on the other hand, you did get science fiction correct.
Yes.
Yay.
Which means that a new study finds that the Earth's magnetic field is much closer to flipping polarity than previously thought it may happen this century is the fiction. There are some scientists who think that we are getting pretty close to the polarity of the Earth's magnetic field flipping. This is based upon the observation that in over recent history, the strength of the Earth's magnetic field has been decreasing. And according to some models, this is what happens when the field is about to flip. It decreases. And then, as Bob says, it can go away for years or decades and then reconstitutes itself with the opposite polarity. However, what the new research shows, which was just published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, is that if you look at the field strengths for the last 5 million years or so, it looks as if that the magnetic field has recently been abnormally strong, and it may just be returning to its long-term background.
Homeostasis?
From a peak. Right? It's possible that it was abnormally high. Now it's just returning to its baseline. Not that it's on the wane getting ready to flip. It may not be getting ready to flip at all is what they're saying.
Yeah, so even if it, the fact that it's decreasing, we are so far above average that it would, even if we are heading straight for a flip, it's going to take a long time because we're far above the average.
Yeah, right.
Do we have evidence of how often these flips, like how many times they've happened and how far apart they were?
Several hundred times over the past 100 million years, most recently 780,000 years ago.
Oh, wow. That wasn't that long ago.
Yeah. So I remember when I was doing research for this that, yeah, we're overdue, actually. We're actually statistically overdue. But there have been flips that the flips are variable. I think some of them were 10 flips in a million years or one flip in many millions of years. So it's not like a steady thing. But yeah, so we don't have to worry for a while. But it's not going to be fun when it does happen.
Yeah, we'll be dead.
Yeah, so we'll just have to make our own magnetosphere when that time comes. It's so far away, we'll be able to do it.
Yeah.
I'm confident.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah, even if it's in 1,000 years, imagine the tech we'll have then.
Oh, God.
you can't even imagine. You can't speculate that far.
No, you can't. It's beyond our ken, especially – oh, don't get me started.
Yeah. All right, well.
We'll try.
let's just move on to the quote. Evan, give us a quote this week.
It's not like we want to live forever now, do we? Here's the quote. A professor can never better distinguish himself in his work than by encouraging a clever pupil, for the true discoverers are among them, as comets among the stars. Almost sounds like something Carl Sagan might have said at one point, but that was actually Carl Linnaeus. Or is it Linnaeus? Cool. Linnaeus. Carl Linnaeus. And a Swedish botanist, physician, and zoologist who laid the foundations for the modern biological naming scheme that we enjoy today as taxonomy. He's the father of modern taxonomy. Considered also one of the fathers of modern ecology. Was born in 1707, died 1778.
Yeah, prior to Linnaeus, it was a mess. The official naming system of species was just crazy. You know, they would have these long names and there was no real pattern among them. Linnaeus came up with what's called the binomial naming system, like Homo sapiens. You have a genus name and a species name, and every species has a unique binomial, usually Latin, you know, designation. That was him. Yeah, so that's the system now that we have.
And as far as the quote goes, I think what he's saying here is that, look, as a teacher, as a professor, as a mentor to other people, you're doing your best work by encouraging your students, your pupils, to strive for greatness and to let them to help them blossom and become the next generation of great thinkers, great scientists, and great people. They are budding, and with your help as a professor, they can become, you know, look, the sky's the limit. And yeah. it is very important. So it's a good quote.
I'm not sure I get the comet and the stars allusion there. I mean, it's, I guess he's being poetic.
Yeah, it's a bit
flowery.
It's poetic, you know, 18th century and, you know, still just kind of getting their grasp of this cosmos and stuff.
All right. Well, good job, everyone. You guys swept me this week.
Thanks, Steve.
And thank you for joining me this week.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes,
I hope you guys will all enjoy your Thanksgiving. We're recording this just a couple of days before Thanksgiving.
Always a good time. Good food, good family, good football.
Good football.
So, Steve, you're coming over?
Yeah.
So, should we talk about politics first or religion?
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.